This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused pharmaceutical company, and as a sustainable company accredited with both a B Corp and Benefit Corporation status, Chiesi is making global changes that benefit patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and whoever you are listening, thank you. So we have finished from the 2024 SCCM Annual Congress in Phoenix, Arizona. The full review with conference correspondent Anthony Hawkins will be coming a little later today. But today's episode will feature numerous pharmacist guests. So first off, we finish highlighting star research presentations from the conference. So Joanna Stallings returns to discuss the effect of antipsychotics on agitation in ICU delirium, secondary analysis of a randomized trial. Now that randomized trial being the MIND-USA trial. And then Lama Nazir highlights not one, but two star research studies, procalcitonin and antimicrobial utilization in critically ill cancer patients with sepsis, the PROCAN study, and then the diagnostic and prognostic value of procalcitonin in critically ill cancer patients with sepsis. So two great star research studies to highlight. And then the daily SCCM recaps end with a really fun roundtable discussion with the CPP year in review speakers or presenters and moderators. So Corinne Berger, Melanie Smith-Condenny, Julie Farah, and Andy Webb. So all four of them come. It's an absolute blast of a conference, of a presentation, and I think you're gonna feel that in the roundtable episodes and, of course, the or interviews and the discussions with the two star pharmacist research presenters. So it's time to end the conference on a high note. Here we go.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're joined by a very special guest, pharmacist star researcher Joanna Stallings. She's coming back. I had to request her back on after such a when she came on and did an absolute awesome discussion on our ACORN trial rapid reaction, which of course she was an author on. So if you haven't listened to that, be sure to go do that. But Joanna is coming here to talk about her star research, The Effect of Antipsychotics on Agitation in ICU Delirium, the Secondary Analysis of a Randomized Trial. Now, reminder, Joanna is the Medical ICU Clinical Pharmacist Specialist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, Post-ICU Recovery Clinic, Critical Care Research Group, numerous other things. Joanna, welcome. Thanks for coming back. How are you?
Thanks, Nick. I'm doing well. Thanks for inviting me to come back.
Yeah, so excited and very, I love the fact that we have such a cool analysis from one of the large randomized trials that you were part of. So tell us a little bit about this STAR research project here.
Okay, so I feel like this is a secondary analysis of the MIND-USA study, so we can't talk about this analysis until you know about the MIND-USA study. So just a refresher, so this was a randomized placebo-controlled trial that patients either received Haldol, Zopiclone, or placebo for treatment of delirium and essentially showed that there was no difference between the three groups. And this was published in the New England Journal in 2018. So obviously there have been some secondary analysis that we wanted to evaluate, one of them specifically looking at agitation, because as I'm sure happens in many of your different ICUs, people use antipsychotics and schedule them in the background for agitation. So specifically, what we did here is we looked at patients and we looked at all their different RAS scores, and any score that was less than zero was equated to a zero essentially. And we found that there was no difference between the three groups with regards to agitation, which I think is definitely practice changing, hopefully. But essentially, it's not helpful to give scheduled antipsychotics for the treatment of agitation.
So correct me if I'm wrong here, but was this secondary analysis essentially trying to test the hypothesis that we know medications probably don't treat hypoactive delirium, but would we see a benefit if we exclusively limited it to the hyperactive delirium, those with a positive RAS score? Or is that not necessarily the target of what you all were thinking?
Very good question, but not necessarily the target, because you have to think about two things. So when MindUSA was published, we did get a little bit of a hard time, because people were like, oh, this is all hypoactive delirium. Nobody uses antipsychotics to treat hypoactive delirium. This is not helpful. But then if you actually look, what is published, like in our table one, that was their first incident of delirium. Was it hyperactive or was it hypoactive? It does not account for what they were throughout the course of their ICU stay, which obviously we know delirium, it's acute fluctuation of mental status. So these people were, when we looked at all their different episodes of delirium, and it was actually a 40% to 60% split. So very even, we'll say very close to even split of hypoactive and hyperactive delirium. So that your question is very good, but you have to consider once again that delirium is fluctuating. So the RAS scores also are fluctuating, right? So because of that, I feel like they may have been delirious at one point throughout the study, and then they may not have been delirious at one point throughout the study. So I don't think that we can apply this to delirium. This specifically focuses on agitation.
That's a really good point, because even though, right, we have the scores, the KMICU scores, but it's essentially a point in time. It's like taking a spot EKG instead of being on a continuous, or a spot EEG instead of being on continuous. That's a really good point. I'm glad you explained that, because I think that's a really good takeaway as you think about applying the findings of this. So in your opinion, do you think, what would your response be if someone said, well, I just don't think you tried high enough doses? Do we think if we did higher doses of haloperidol as a prazosin that we would see any difference? Does it look like it's a lack of a like dose response, I guess?
I don't think that we can really say that, because honestly, when you look at the doses, like the max doses that people could receive was 20 milligrams per day of Haldol and 40 milligrams per day of prazosin, and those aren't baby doses. You know, so I don't think it's really fair to say that. Like, if we, like, before you're in my time, like, I've been told this, like, what would happen is somebody would give, like, 5 milligrams of Haldol and wait, like, 15 to 30 minutes, give 5 more milligrams, wait 15 to 30 minutes, give 5 milligrams of Haldol. And then they would take that cumulative amount it took to get the patient down, we'll say, and give half of that scheduled and half of that PRN, you know. And you can't, I mean, you can't help but wonder, is that safe, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't think that people can really argue that these weren't high enough doses, because it wasn't like we were sprinkling like 1-2 milligrams doses of Haldol that you would use like essentially as like an antiemetic or something. Like, this is real dosing.
This might hurt your brain, what I'm about to tell you, because what you described, that I had learned that at one of my previous centers, but it was a little different, because you started with 5, and if they didn't respond, you doubled it.
Oh my goodness.
So it went 5, 10, 20, and then it was the split. So I had to say that, because I knew that would be your reaction.
Mind blown.
So incorporating these findings from this analysis of the MindUSA study with what we already know, do we think there's a role for routine antipsychotic use or treatment for agitation, routinely at least?
I think that we know now based off of this study that scheduling antipsychotics for agitation does not help. But that being said, if you have an agitated patient and they're going to punch the nurse, they're going to punch you, they're going to like tear apart the bed, run out of the hospital, et cetera, things that really happen. We don't know that antipsychotics are not helpful for that. And we have to have something to acutely treat that patient. So we did not answer that question. So I do think it is appropriate to give as needed antipsychotics in situations like that for severe agitation, but scheduling them is not helpful for agitation.
I have to ask, because you rattled off all those examples really quickly. Are those anecdotes that you have personally known, or did those just come to your mind as things of people getting agitated, like somebody being agitated and just walking out of the unit, trying to leave the hospital? Are those routine happenings?
I mean, unfortunately, those things absolutely happen sometimes.
Yeah, that'll happen. Well, Joanna, thanks so much. My gosh, returning again so quickly. We're so lucky. STAR Research presentation, secondary analysis of the MIND-USA trial. Thanks so much. Always appreciate you.
Thank you, Nick.
Very lucky to be joined by, of course, another Pharmacist STAR Research presenter, Lama Nazar. Now, not one, but two STAR Research abstracts, which is absolutely unbelievable. And she's been gracious enough to join, get to highlight some of these. The first procalcitonin and antimicrobial utilization in critically ill cancer patients with sepsis, the PROCAN study. Love that that's an acronym, right? And then the other being the diagnostic and prognostic value of procalcitonin in critically ill cancer patients with sepsis. Now, Lama is a critical care clinical pharmacy specialist at the King Hussein Cancer Center in Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. Doing very well. Thank you.
So I have to ask, out of curiosity, what was your flight or travel day like on your way to come here to us at the Congress in Phoenix?
It was a long flight.
Yeah.
It felt like it was never ending, but I got used to it. After a while, but it was fairly long.
Are you a plane sleeper? Were you able to get a little shut-eye, or are you one of the people where you're on a plane, that's it, you're never going to be able to sleep?
I mean, I'll probably get a few hours of sleep, but out of 14 hours, there's still so much to go.
That doesn't add up, yeah.
there's still a lot of hours to finish.
100%. Well, obviously, the real reason that we're here is we want to hear a little bit more about your study and specifically your research into procalcitonin in your unit. So if you don't mind, talk a little bit about these two studies, these two abstracts, and we'll ask a couple questions.
Sure. Again, thank you for having me on this podcast. So the study is the PROCAN study, where we were, the main objective was to look at the impact of procalcitonin, serial procalcitonin levels using a procalcitonin algorithm, and whether that would impact the antibiotic utilization. And we looked specifically at the critically ill cancer patients, which is a challenging patient population when it comes to managing their antibiotics. So it really came out from our clinical practice, where one of the most challenging questions that we get dealing with septic patients with cancer is, when do you stop the antibiotics, or when do you de-escalate? These patients are immune compromised. They have a lot of other underlying comorbidities. It does become a challenging question in terms of when do you stop. The procalcitonin, as you probably know, there's a lot of literature about procalcitonin and how it could actually reduce the duration of antibiotics, but there's nothing that has specifically looked at cancer patients. And in fact, a lot of the studies have actually excluded patients that are immune compromised and excluded cancer patients. So we wanted to look specifically at this patient population that hasn't been addressed in the literature. It was a randomized controlled study where we randomized patients to either the procalcitonin group or to the standard of care group. Both groups had daily procalcitonin levels checked. The group that was in the procalcitonin arm were given the clinicians were given the procalcitonin levels. They were also given an algorithm to guide them in terms of how they can adjust the antibiotics. The other group, which was the usual care, they still had the procalcitonin levels measured, but the levels were blinded, so none of the team members knew what the levels were. By the end of the study, again, our main objective was antibiotic utilization, so looking to whether there's a difference in terms of antibiotic duration in the procalcitonin versus the usual care group. Based on our findings, we did not find any difference. There was no statistically significant difference between both groups. Based on this, the findings, it did not seem to impact the decisions or to impact the utilization. I'll add a caveat here that we did not obtain the entire sample size that we were targeting. So there is the potential that it could be underpowered. Unlikely, given the results that we have and given the differences that we were seeing. But again, that is a possibility. The main reason for that was the fact that we had to hold the study during COVID. So there's a part of that study that ran through COVID, so we had to hold that. Now, the other part of that study is we took kind of another, the second phase or the sub-analysis of that study was looking at whether procalcitonin could actually predict mortality and whether procalcitonin could predict positive cultures within this patient population. So we took the procalcitonin level at baseline and looked at whether there's an association with, again, ICU mortality, hospital mortality, and the positive cultures. It was a very weak association, so we could not find a strong association. We took that a step further and said, well, maybe it's not the procalcitonin at baseline. Maybe it's the rate of decline that could potentially predict outcomes. So we looked at the 30% decline in procalcitonin at day 72 and whether that predicts ICU mortality, hospital mortality, or could predict positive cultures. And it was a very weak association with the three of them. So in terms of being a predictor, based at least on those outcomes that we looked at and those measures, it was a very weak predictor. So that's kind of...
Well, what a great and novel study idea, right? Trying to answer a question because, yeah, and trying to help solve antimicrobial use in cancer patients is certainly an endeavor that we're still trying to figure out. So, number one, kudos because, you know, you're completing a randomized controlled trial. That's awesome, right? That puts you in a rare group of researchers. So that's, you know, you deserve all the credit for leading. And of course, your awesome research team, right? Research is never a one-person thing. But what would you say is the most challenging part of completing an RCT in the ICU?
I would say in my situation, I would say there were two main challenging parts. The first challenging part is what I mentioned earlier as far as having COVID running through the time frame of that study. So that was a major obstacle in terms of us being able to complete the entire sample size. We have an immune compromised patient population, so there were very strict limitations in terms of what kind of research could be conducted during that COVID pandemic. And the other part that I would say was challenging but eye-opening is conducting a randomized controlled trial in my ICU. So this was, I would say, the first randomized controlled study to be conducted in our ICU. So it was a new concept. You know, everybody knew about randomized controlled trials, but it's completely different than running an actual RCT. The team was extremely supportive, you know, whether it's physicians, whether it's nurses, whether it's pharmacists, the entire team was very supportive. But again, it is something that has not been done before. So the logistics of an RCT and the process was something that we had to make sure that everybody was on board with. It went very well, but again, it's eye-opening in terms of some of the logistics that go with an RCT that need to be planned along the way.
You know, obviously you have to go to like IRBs and things, but did you have to talk to the unit and get their approval to kind of go through? Like, did you have to talk about what logistically that would look like, or did you get the trial, was it approved? And as you're going forward, then you work with them. What's the process there from a unit perspective?
From a unit perspective, the way I generally conduct my research, regardless what type of research is being conducted in the ICU, I like to get the team, or at least the medical team and the in-charge nurses on board in terms of what the plan is, just so that, you know, everybody feels that they're on the same page. Again, it's a very supportive team, so no one has, you know, no one typically goes against what is planned unless there's a reason for that. But yeah, we had actually physicians, we had nurses on board with us on this RCT as part of the research team. We talked about the logistics, we talked about the process, and then once we kind of agreed on how we're going to go about things, then we submitted the full proposal to the IRB. So I'm someone that likes to just make sure that that everybody's on the same page before we actually take a step forward. And again, it's all been positive and they've always been supportive with that.
That's how I know I'm talking to a clinical researcher, because it's right. Like you want to get everything approved ahead of time, no roadblocks, all those things. And of course, like, you know, you want to make sure that what you're doing, you know, is in line with everyone's on the same page and we're going towards the same goal. So that's a really good, that's just good advice no matter what research you're doing, right? Exactly. So I'm glad that you highlighted that.
And I think with this specific study, the procalcitonin arm required that the physicians make decisions based on the algorithm. So we had to make sure that they're aware of what the algorithm is, they understand what the requirements are, and we still kept it up to the clinician to finally decide, to eventually decide on what the plan is. But again, there was a part where, regardless whether they're part of the study or not, they will be given that procalcitonin level and they will be given the algorithm to make a decision based on it. So definitely they had to be on board with that.
So you talked about your results. So how will that impact, like how was procalcitonin being used at all? Like how do you anticipate this changing practice, if at all, kind of in your unit?
So procalcitonin wasn't very commonly used, but it was used frequently in our patients. And we were using it based on what was reported in other studies, saying that procalcitonin could be helpful in terms of guiding the antibiotic treatment. But in practice, when we were getting the procalcitonin levels, it did not really have a big impact on the decisions that we were making. So it was used sporadically, and it varied in terms of whether, you know, there are some people that would get a single level, others that would get serial levels. But the literature does report that patients with cancer may have elevated procalcitonin levels just due to cancer itself, because they have an increase in the inflammatory mediators. So does this mean that if I get a high procalcitonin level on day one or day two, does that necessarily mean that it's an infectious process, or maybe it's due to the underlying malignancy? And that's the reason why we decided to do the study with the serial procalcitonin, is to really kind of get a better idea of whether that procalcitonin is high due to cancer or there are other factors related to it. So in terms of, you know, how would that impact our practice moving forward, at this point, we still need to do additional analysis for the study and kind of stratify patients and look at specific cohorts of patients. But the general impression from the findings is that procalcitonin is not something that needs to be done for every single patient, and those serial levels are not what would really impact antibiotic utilization. So that's kind of the general impression from those findings. But again, it could be that maybe procalcitonin would benefit certain subgroups of patients, and that's what we're going to be looking at more closely.
Well, what an awesome study idea. What a great research, not only idea, but execution. Now, I'd be remiss, right, in the introduction. You know, you're practicing as a clinical pharmacist in Jordan. And so is there, especially for myself, the listeners, are there big differences or things that would stand out or surprising to us from, you know, your practice at King Hussein Cancer Center in Jordan compared to, say, you know, somebody at a hospital or health system in the U.S.?
I have to say that I'm fortunate working at King Hussein Cancer Center, because we pretty much have a strong support for clinical pharmacy in the institution. And it's I would say, one of the pioneers in terms of incorporating clinical pharmacists into the medical teams. So we have clinical pharmacists on every single team in the inpatient setting. We also have clinical pharmacists that are integrated in the outpatient settings. And physicians really rely on clinical pharmacists. So I don't see it very much different than, for example, in a health institution or a hospital in the U.S. that has clinical pharmacists on board or part of the ICU team. Now, how things are in you know, other institutions in Jordan, it will likely be different. But I have to say, within KHCC, things are pretty good in terms of the model that we have for clinical pharmacists.
And for those who were at the pre-Congress session, correct? They were lucky enough to hear you get to talk a little bit about like your practice there, is that correct?
Yeah, so in the pre-Congress forum, CPP forum, I talked about the critical care pharmacy practice in Jordan. So it was not just about KHCC, but just kind of shedding some light on how the practice is in Jordan. And I also touched on the part related to the pharmacy education and training, because a large part of that will have an impact in terms of the scope and the depth of involvement that the clinical pharmacist would have in the ICU setting, because the training model is somehow different than the US. So that, again, that does have an impact on kind of the practice, the impact on practice.
Well, thank you so much for joining again the ProCan, one of two of her star research abstracts, Lama Nazir. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you so much. Thanks for
thank
joining
you very
us.
Much. Thank you very much for your time.
This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Now, the moderators and presenters from the CPP Year in Review session join to highlight their awesome talk and session. All right, friends, we are here. We're in the West Building. We traveled across the street, and I'm outside the room with three presenters and the moderators from the Year in Review, the Clinical Pharmacy and Pharmacology session, closing out Tuesday. So what we're going to do, we're going to have a little bit of fun, talk with the presenters and moderators, but just so we know, set the scene, who's here, let's kind of go around the circle, because we are literally in the foyer standing in a circle with two microphones for five of us. So we're just crushing it today on Tuesday. So let's go around a circle. Corinne, let's just start with you.
Hey, everybody. I'm Corinne Berger. I'm an assistant professor of pharmacy practice at Nova Southeastern University, and I have a practice site in the medical and trauma ICU at Broward Health Medical Center.
Hey, everyone. My name's Julie Farah. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Tennessee College of Pharmacy, and I practice as a clinical specialist in the trauma ICU and with the nutrition support service at Regional One Health in Memphis, Tennessee.
Hi, everyone. My name's Andy Webb. I'm a neurocritical care clinical pharmacist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi there. I'm Melanie Smith-Condini, and I am a clinical pharmacy specialist in the surgery, trauma, and burn ICU at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, South Carolina.
Could have just said we have a who's who of pharmacists from the SCCM CPP section, but love that talk about a who's who of speakers, so I can't wait to dive in. But we've got a couple questions for the moderator, for Corinne, to start off our discussion here. So there were three incredible presentation titles within the session. They were so good, I actually didn't want to pick, so I'm going to shift that burden to you and ask you which presentation title made you laugh the most.
Oh, gosh. I think I'm going to have to go with You're in Good Hands.
It was really good. Julie, you gave the credit away. No one would have known. You could have just accepted it.
I couldn't take the credit. I couldn't do it. Paul is one of my mentors, and so, you know, game has to recognize game. Like, he deserved it.
Were you giving him credit because you were worried that was going to flop a little bit, or was that your hedge?
Absolutely not. I knew it was going to be a hit. I just had to give the shout out and, you know, the credit where credit was due.
Yeah. Okay. So, Corinne, last day of Congress, it's a large group of pharmacists. Who were you more worried about as you were at the front of the stage? The three presenters to your left or the audience of pharmacists on the last day of a conference?
100% the audience. Pharmacist presenters are very by the book, and they know their timing, and we talked about the timing before, during, and even after the presentation. So I would say the audience.
Was there an emergency mute button? Is there like a, what was the strategy if things went off the rails?
No mute button, but I'm pretty good at just redirecting the conversation, I guess. So I had some ideas in mind for how to shift back over, which were almost implemented right at the end.
We got close, but we almost had to implement them. It is a good thing you had plan B and C. All great questions. Okay, that was great. So
we were able to survive in advance.
Surviving. Yeah, well, you know, when you're answering three, four, maybe even five questions in... with wrapped into one, that's just, you got to give kudos to you all, the incredible presenters, speakers. All right, so We want everyone to listen to the presentation, and you all highlighted awesome things. So what I want you to do, highlight what you think is your most fun fact from your presentation. So let us know.
I discussed as one of the trials in my presentation today, the ACORN clinical trial, and I think the most fun fact that I can give to the audience is that Joanna Stallings was an author on that paper. A very, very well-known pharmacist, the previous chair of the CPP. And so I think it's just really fun that we get to talk about these big trials that are practice-changing, and pharmacists are out there, you know, paving the way for us.
I mean, I think mine's going to be unconventional. I think my girlfriend's going to be particularly proud that I fit a Taylor Swift reference into my presentation. So I think that's probably the most fun fact from mine, that I was able to tie that together, make her very proud.
How much help or assistance did she give you for that reference?
I have received a comprehensive education on the lore and ethos of Taylor Swift, so I feel like I was well prepared to come up with that on my own.
You've been baptized in Taylor.
I have, yes. But other than that, I think my favorite thing from my presentation was that I was able to present another presentation where I was able to give a little sneak peek of the Anexa Eye trial, which has yet to be published, but kind of give just the taste of what is yet to come and hopefully get people's gears turning as we're waiting for that full manuscript.
I have been waiting to see since it stopped so early.
And they let you know. It was stopped early. Did you hear?
There are different tiers of ads and signs you can buy.
When there are cappuccinos available with a stamp on the top that say Anexa Eye was finished early, that's when you know.
Is that that?
I had at least two of them.
I love that. I love that. I will say that there was Portola, maybe, whoever makes PCC, they had a coffee stand and indexed it. So out of Team PCC, I went to the lesser coffee stand to try to fight the good fight. Okay, Melanie, wrap us up here. What was your fun fact?
I've been hearing about this all year, so I think my fun fact is that orthopedic surgeons got a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Did you hear that? Did you know? Ortho got a paper in the New England Journal.
Exactly.
Oh yes, hallelujah. That's exactly right. All right, so let's go reverse, because you all got to highlight, you know, updates and topics that came out. So what's like an honorable mention that maybe just missed the cut? Because obviously, and we'll get into what it's like trying to talk about a year in 10 to 15 minutes. So what are some honorable mentions maybe that did anything come to mind from that perspective?
So for me, it's interesting that you asked this question, because my presentation actually looked very different until the ACORN trial was published. I think the challenge with nephrology is that there's a lot of concepts and things that we're not necessarily applying to practice quite yet. One of the things I really wanted to potentially discuss was the removal of race from the CKD IPA equation, and talk about, you know, how that affects the way that we care for patients, social determinants of health, and again, you know, in a critically ill population that may or may not have been totally applicable, and also from a drug dosing perspective, it may not have been totally applicable. But that was actually, you know, kind of my third player in terms of trials to discuss.
Yeah, I think probably the one that almost made the cut for me was one of the most recent Tenecteplase trials. I feel like I have been Tenecteplase man for the last year and a half at my hospital and all of our system hospitals. And so there was a recent Tenecteplase trial that came out that was, once again, showing Tenecteplase works just as well as Alteplase, that I did want to talk about but didn't quite make the cut.
Wait, I have to ask. So are you the neuro version of the Florida man? Is that the Tenecteplase man?
That's it. I run around with my little vial and the dosing table, and I'm yelling that it's good. It's good. Everyone should use it.
And you see your lookalikes in the Grand Theft Auto commercials. Yep. Okay. Perfect.
Okay, I'm going to say my third place study, just because of the name, the Cryostat 2 randomized clinical trial
that looked at
high dose empirical cryoprecipitate in trauma, and kind of similar to the four factor PCC study, they didn't find any benefit to using high dose cryoprecipitate in those patients.
I mean, there's so many good trials trying to narrow down, talking about, you know, 2, 3, 4. Andy, the fact that you reviewed that, I mean, it's kind of unbelievable. Shout out to Andy there. So how do you approach, because I'm curious your all's opinion on this, how do you approach a presentation where the objective is reviewing pertinent updates from the past year. Like, how do you even approach and figure out what trials you're going to talk about, and maybe compared to like how you prepare for like a clinical session, like if you're talking about VTE management or, you know, sepsis management, things like that?
I can start this one because I approached it like a systematic review, you know, typical type A pharmacist. I thought of every journal that I could possibly think of that had to do with trauma, and I did a full table of content review of those journals for the past year. And that took a while. I probably wouldn't do that for a regular session, but I was able to, you know, find the top trials that way.
Yeah, honestly, I have to say I'm a little similar. I did take the slightly even nerdier way of doing it, where I designed a automated PubMed search that sent me updates every week. And so I built the
I wish everyone could see the look of every of all the, of everyone else's.
I own that I am chief nerd, right? And so
it's
I built
cool to
out
be a nerd for the,
yeah, right?
For the record.
So I built out all the key stuff and had PubMed shoot me an email every week if anything new came out. And obviously I also have to plug Twitter. I did find several of my studies on Twitter.
I mean, I bet that was easier. We're laughing at you, but that probably was way easier than these methods that I'm doing.
Honestly. I definitely was the same as Melanie. I was not the same as Andy. That's okay. I will also say, I might be outing myself a little bit with this, but one of the first conversations that Erin Barreto and I had, she was my clinical mentor for this presentation. She and I had known each other before, so this was not weird when she said this to me, but she said, "Nephrology is not really your wheelhouse, is it?" I was like, "No," and I'm glad we're on the same page. But I think that there's a lot of tangential overlap with what I do and being able to think about the way that the kidneys work and the way that we dose drugs. So she was a vital source of information for me and definitely helped guide me in the right direction as to what would be pertinent to our audience.
Thank you for clarifying that that wasn't your first interaction, because that probably would have struck a bolt of lightning
in you.
Don't
worry. That was your first. Erin and I were friends before that.
Yeah, so you and the kidney, huh? So we've been talking about the CPP, right? The clinical pharmacy and pharmacology section. This is the featured session for that section. That's tongue twister. So what exactly is the CPP? Why is it so awesome? Why are there so many pharmacists filling this room? Like, what? Like, give the pitch to listeners who may not be CPP members for whatever reason. If you're not, what are you doing? But Corinne, what is the CPP?
Oh my goodness! Are there any pharmacists who aren't members of the CPP? I need to find them.
I certainly hope not.
The CPP is really the pharmacist, critical care pharmacist home within SCCM, and it is a very large but also very tight-knit network of pharmacists and also non-pharmacists. So there are many non-pharmacist members of CPP as well, so we welcome anybody who has an interest in pharmacy or pharmacology within all of the specialties. So trauma, I shouldn't even try to name them all because I'll forget them. And we collaborate on research. We put out educational products. We put out references and things like that, resources for all the members of the society. And this particular section is really just our year in review, talking about all the literature associated with pharmacology. And of course, it's going to touch on every other section too, because it's going to relate to pharmacology within our various specialties.
Yeah, I mean, it's so cool being able to share a room with not only icons who are publishing and writing these research papers we're talking about, but also, right, talking about the people who are doing the most up-and-coming research now, right, the ones that have done 1, 3, 5 years. So it really is, like, the best of both worlds. It's such an unbelievable place to, like, network. Everyone's willing to help. You have the mentor-mentee program. It's awesome.
100%. And like Julie had mentioned, even within the audience, a lot of the people are on the papers that are being discussed and just listening intently and smiling and supporting. So it's really great to see that too.
That's a step below the flex, which is where you reference your own paper in your own slides.
Everybody's
that
goal.
Is the ultimate. That's the best, right? Okay. I got a little beef though. This airing of the grievances session. What do we need to do? Who do we need to petition for this not to be the last day and the second to last session?
That's a great question. I think our new incoming chair, Megan Reck, our first priority is actually getting another bartender for the reception. But very close after that will be figuring out a better place for this section. From what I understand is we have this place to keep everybody here as long as possible since we're one of the best sessions. But certainly we would be very open to going earlier in the program as well.
So it's meant to be a compliment because we're one of the noteworthy ones. Okay, well, they can compliment us in other ways. We can find new ways to do that, right? All right, to end it, I think a lot of times as a speaker, a moderator, most of what you're getting or you're getting feedback, what you did great, what you could improve on. All right, we're going to flip it a little bit here. We're going to ask you all, what could we, the audience, have done better to support you all? Could we, what, better clapping, louder laughs, better head nods, better eye contact when you're looking for someone to, like, support you through your slide transition? What do you think? How do we do, and what can we do better?
Well, I think that what probably most people would say is that we want the audience to come in and be a little closer to us occasionally. I think we all probably have been in that position where we like to sit towards the back and kind of hang out and be able. I personally do like to chat during presentations and get people's opinions, you know, that I'm with. But I think that having a little bit more audience closeness so that we can make eye contact and have the head nods, I think that would be fantastic.
Okay, now I do have one question here. Julia, where was I sitting if you had to guess?
In the back.
In the very back table, in
yes.
The back corner. Now, granted, I needed a table and things, but I just wanted to Fair out enough. Myself there.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Yeah, I will say the nodder, when you get a nod, I had a nodder, and it was phenomenal. I locked on. He was.
Is that so? Is your move?
His head.
Is your move like finding a group or section or a person, or are you foreheads and distance?
I like seeing that there's at least a single person who seems to be interested, and that is enough for me, you know. And if I had that one person
who was
with me, he was, you know, nodding along, and that meant a lot. Two would be good, you know. Maybe even two.
Are you looking for people in your group, or are you looking for strangers in the crowd?
I am very open. I like, you know, a good person who's just interested. Maybe if I know him, I don't know him, it doesn't really matter to me.
My ideal audience would include more cowbell.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Just a little fun.
That's amazing.
Audience.
And with that, what better way to close? Thank you all so much. CPP year in review. Be sure to listen to that on the Digital Congress. Appreciate you all coming in, having some fun, ending our Congress out this daily review. Thank you all so much. Can't thank everyone enough for all their help with joining me for interviews and discussions. Giving feedback all throughout the 2024 SACM Congress. It's amazing. These episodes definitely wouldn't be the same without you all. Very, very, very grateful. Also, absolutely love everyone that comes up and says, hey, I hope everyone that does that can feel how much it makes my day, how much I love hearing some of those things. So thank you all so much that do that. Remember, give a follow at Pharmacy to Dose for lots of great updates throughout the conference. And even when a conference isn't happening, so at Pharmacy to Dose. And until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only and does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. Users and patients should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACCP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.